Well, good evening. It's been rather a long time, I feel like. An entire summer seems to have come and gone since I was up here doing this. But I understand you went through a few books during the summer from Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, and Daniel with my dad. So we are going to be picking up now with the last main section of the Old Testament, the books of the minor prophets. And for this section, we are going to approach it a little bit differently than we have up to now. For the first 26 books of the Bible, we approach them in the order that they appear in our Bible. So we started at Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, etc. But now that we're in the minor prophets, because these books are so small and because they're really not very well known, at least for me, and I'm sure many others as well, we are actually going to analyze these books to the best effort that we can make in a chronological sequence. So we're going to start with the book of Obadiah, following the outline of the minor prophets that is given in our textbook, if you have been reading that. And also, if you have been reading your textbook, you'll realize that there is a small chapter between the books of the major prophets and the books of the minor prophets. That chapter discusses the prophetic office. So I'd like to take a few minutes now. We're getting into some of the more in-depth books with the major and minor prophets. So I think we do need to address what is the prophetic office, and what was it throughout the years? So, if you were to back way up, way back to the beginning, almost a year ago now, when we started with Genesis, Exodus, and the books of the Pentateuch, we studied a man named Moses, the author of those books, and the first in the line of prophetic people, the first to hold the prophetic office. He delivered the law to the nation of Israel, and recorded the first initial years of the Jewish national history as they moved out of the land of Egypt into the land of Canaan. But when he died, his writing and his function as a prophet was taken over by his successor, Joshua. Joshua then began to write in the books of history, and when he died, he was followed by successors, and you start to see a little bit more of a branching out and the prophets until you get to Samuel, who wrote many of the other Old Testament books of history, including the books that bear his name, 1st and 2nd Samuel, the majority of them at least. And then other prophets involved in 1st and 2nd Kings and Chronicles. But as you look through these books, you discover that hundreds of men and women, even in some cases, exercised this office of prophet. Hundreds might seem to be stretching it just a little bit, but I don't feel it is a stretch because there is one instance in particular that we will get to a little bit later tonight where we find a man named Obadiah, probably not the same as the author of the book we're studying, but a man named Obadiah who was a servant to King Ahab who hid 100 prophets from the king when he was trying to kill them. So right there you've got 100 prophets. And that's just a small instance in Jewish history. So if you were to stretch that out over several hundred years, I don't think it is at all a stretch to assume that there would have been hundreds of prophets during these Old Testament times. The Old Testament books were written by prophets, beginning with Moses, as we discussed in the Pentateuch. The books of history with Samuel, Joshua, and others. But as you get up to the books of poetry especially, you start to find a new class of writer. David, one of the authors of many of the Psalms, Solomon, the author of Proverbs, and some of the other books of wisdom. These men weren't truly the office of the prophet, but yet they fulfilled the prophetic role because they foretold in some cases and foretold in other cases things that God wanted them to relay. When you get through the books of poetry, you start into the books of the major and the minor prophets. Now, sometimes it is assumed that these last two groups, the major and minor prophets, make distinctions between the class of prophet. So Isaiah was a major prophet. He was important. And Obadiah, a small book, was a minor prophet, not so important. Well, that's not really what they're trying to say in the distinction. It is something of a misnomer because it does not refer to their importance. Rather, it refers to the amount of material and the breadth of the material that they addressed. So naturally, because Isaiah is a much larger book than Obadiah, he's got a lot more information in it, addressed not just to Israel, but to the surrounding nations. Whereas the book of Obadiah, a short book, is very focused in on one nation, one people group, the Edomites, as we'll see later. So the major and minor prophets, not given that name to distinguish their importance. Every book of the Bible is important. It's all profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, and instruction in righteousness. They're all in the Bible, and we can learn from all of them. Just some prophets focused on a lot more material than others. So the purpose of the prophetic office. The prophets were intended to be God's messengers to his people. And that's what we see. Many times, as these prophets are writing, they say, "Thus saith the Lord." And then, moving on, they give a message. But a lot of times, these messages are simply preaching applications of God's already revealed law. So when the prophets came and said, "Listen, you have to leave these people alone, or God is going to send judgment," they weren't giving any new information necessarily. God had already told the Jews back in the law what would happen if they failed to obey him and if they failed to keep away from the pagan inhabitants of the land of Canaan. But then they also, in some instances, foretold events and people. I think especially of the book of Isaiah. Isaiah wrote a chapter foretelling the events of Christ's crucifixion with an amount of detail that is astounding considering how many years it predates Christ's coming. Then in other instances, there are events that are foretold. Cyrus the king is foretold before he even came into the world. And many times these prophets, what we think of as a prophet, their role was to foretell. So looking ahead into the future, reveal what God wanted his people to know about future events and people. But as a function of all of these aspects of the prophetic office, they encouraged holy living by reminding Israel of promised judgments if they failed, and by failed to live holy lives dedicated to God. As we read through the Old Testament, we find that the prophetic office had several names. So as we get into this first one, I'd actually like us to turn to Exodus chapter 7. Exodus chapter 7. The prophetic office is called prophet. But there's something in these verses that I'd like to show you that kind of adds a little bit more depth to the meaning of the word prophet. Beginning in verses 1 and 2. Of Exodus chapter 7. These are God's instructions to Moses as he is preparing to go back to the land of Egypt and address Pharaoh. "And the Lord said unto Moses, See, I have made thee a god to Pharaoh, and Aaron, thy brother, shall be thy prophet. Thou shalt speak all that I command thee, and Aaron, thy brother, shall speak unto Pharaoh, that he send the children of Israel out of his land." The word prophet means the mouth of God. So when God's prophets came to people and spoke to them, they were functioning as his mouthpiece, just like Aaron was functioning as Moses' mouthpiece in front of Pharaoh. Another name for prophet, one that comes up rather frequently, is the word seer, quite literally one who sees. Let's turn to 1 Samuel 9. First Samuel chapter 9. verses 9 through 11. Before time in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, thus he spake, "Come, and let us go to the seer." For he that is now called a prophet was before time called a seer. So then this instance with Saul and his servant. Then said Saul to his servant, "Well said, come, let us go." So they went unto the city where the man of God was. And as they went up the hill to the city, they found young maidens going out to draw water, and said unto them, "Is the seer here?" So Saul, when he went to seek for wisdom from God, went to a seer, which is the same thing as a prophet identified by these verses, but just an older name for the same office. Now, the seer especially draws emphasis to the method of revelation that God gave them, one who sees, as in one who sees dreams and visions that came directly from God. But the prophets are also known very frequently in the Old Testament as God's servants. Not literally God's servants, but the servant of God. And in a world when God's servant, being God's servant, could cost one his life, it is encouraging to realize that this close association with God was what gave the prophet his authority. A prophet didn't have to go stand in front of a people group and say, "This is my words, you better listen to me." As one who spoke with the mouth of God and God's authority behind him, he could go stand in front of kings and say, "Thus saith the Lord, do this or this will happen." And many prophets, although they must have been uncomfortable, probably found comfort and assurance in the fact that they could rest assured on the authority behind their words, not just in the fact that they had a message to share. So now we're actually going to get into the book of Obadiah. The book of Obadiah, as my dad mentioned, it is probably the shortest book in the Old Testament, comprised entirely of one chapter. The author's name, Obadiah, is shared by several men in the Old Testament. I referenced one of them already. This was the first one, the one who hid prophets during Ahab's reign, 1 Kings 18. He hid 100 prophets from King Ahab, but he was not only a God-fearer, he also was in a high position in Ahab's kingdom. Ahab had sent Obadiah to find Elijah, and he was with Ahab when Elijah revealed himself to Ahab. Another man named Obadiah was one of David's soldiers when he was running from King Saul. And another, Obadiah, was one of Joab's sons who returned from Babylon. So way on down in the future, after the book of Obadiah had already passed. And there was another Obadiah who was a porter at the gate of Babylon. None of these people quite meets the criteria to be this prophet. So the first two are the only ones that could possibly be it from the time, as we'll discuss later. But the last two, they were too late. Of these first two, the Bible never mentions that Obadiah, Ahab's servant, functioned as a prophet. It mentioned that he hid the prophets, not that he was one. And the one who was David's soldier doesn't really seem to fit the description either. He's mentioned very briefly and doesn't necessarily have the same emphasis given to him as other prophets would in the Bible. So, as we read through this very short book, we're left with a very short subtitle, Esau's Destruction. Why Esau? Well, Esau and his descendants became known as Edom and the Edomites. And this book of Obadiah is written entirely against the Edomites and their civilization in Mount Seir. And it prophesies their destruction. In summary, Esau's descendants, Edomites, are destroyed or will be destroyed for their proud offenses against Israel. In order to understand this very short book, I think looking at the background will be very beneficial. So if you go way back in time, the Edomites and the Israelites were closely related people groups. Edom descended from Esau. His family lived in Mount Seir. So if you read in Genesis 36:8, which we will skip over for the time being, we find that he lived in a rock city that was relatively impenetrable. Most scholars today identify that city as the modern ruins of Petra. And I have a picture up there, the treasury literally carved into the rock face. Now, this Petra is inside a valley that you have to go through a rock wall to get to, as I understand. So that made a very defensible city, and one that understandably would give rise to a significant amount of confidence in its defensibility. But that's Esau. Israel descended from Jacob. So Jacob and Esau, brothers, went their separate ways when Jacob deceived his father. He went and had to run away from home. Esau stayed and vowed to kill Jacob. Well, after several years, many years, Jacob comes home and makes up with Esau, and everything seems to be good. They're not going to kill each other anymore. They don't have to run. They live more or less in peace in the same area of the world for many years until Jacob finds out that his long-lost son Joseph is alive and in Egypt. At which point, he leaves to go find Joseph in Egypt, and there's really no more contact between these two people groups for about 400 years, the length of time that Israel was a slave down in Egypt. When they come back, however, on their way to the Promised Land, they are run into Moab or Edom, and either of those countries is the only way for them to get through to the Promised Land the way that God is directing. So at this time, Edom refused to allow the Israelites to march through on their way to the Promised Land. As a matter of fact, at one point, their armies came out armed against the nation of Israel and said, "You will not pass our land." They were very serious about defending their home from the Israelites. So this is 400 years. These were brothers. In 400 years, one wouldn't think that their languages had even changed that much. So 400 years ago, for us, that'd be like trying to read the King James. That's how much linguistic change has happened now. And way back then, one would assume it was roughly the same thing. These were people groups that probably spoke the same language, probably understood each other. It'd be like us getting into a conflict with Great Britain if we'd gone two different directions in 1618. Different people groups, but still very similar. Edom later joined an army in attacking Israel. Now, I would like us to turn to this verse because it's very important for the theme, as we will discover later. 1 Samuel 14:47. So Saul took the kingdom over Israel and fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab and against the children of Ammon and against Edom and against the kings of Zobah and against the Philistines, and whithersoever he turned himself, he vexed them. So Edom apparently had become a significant enough thorn in the side that Saul had to go out and fight against them. And then later, Edom became a tributary of David. We won't read that verse, but in 2 Samuel 8:14, we find out that they have been subjugated and they are tribute now to the kingdom of Israel. When the kingdom of Israel began to fragment with King Solomon's dissension into sin, however, they revolted, Edom revolted, and set up its own series of kings and dukes. So for a very brief time, Edom was under Israel, but then it became its own nation once again. This revolt would have been considered something of a violent revolt, and the time when Edom was attacking Israel would also have been considered a violent time. And those are important for establishing the date of the book, because this book of Obadiah condemns Edom, especially for violence done to Israel. Now, I haven't had you actually open to the book of Obadiah yet, but let's go ahead and find that really quickly. The book of Obadiah, since there's no other chapter than chapter 1, verse 10 of Obadiah. For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. So here, God is promising that the violence they did to Israel when it was a nation, whether that was under Saul's reign or when they revolted later on, that violence merited their destruction before God and in God's sight. So when was that? When did that destruction occur? Well, the book obviously would have occurred before the destruction. So when we look at Jeremiah, which is written in the 500s, the prophecy seems to have already come true in 49:7-22. Again, we won't read that. So Obadiah must have been an earlier prophet than Jeremiah, especially, but possibly even earlier than that, as early as the 800s BC. In his book, it's a very simple outline, very short book, not much to it. It starts with an introduction, introducing the prophet, the man Obadiah, and the purpose for his prophecy, and continuing on then, describing the fallacy of Edom's pride. Edom's pride was what lifted them up as a nation. They had placed their capital in a high place, the high places of the rocks, and they thought that because they were in such a defensible location, they were safe. But their pride, which lifted them up, was not really true safety, because they offended God, a holy God, and when God decreed their fall, they fell. God said that all their secret places would be revealed, even though they thought that they were forever secure. After that, it continues on with the reason for judgment. And the reason for judgment, as we just read, was apparently due to two thoughts. First, the violence against Jacob. But second, they had watched when Israel was attacked at a later time and rejoiced at their fall and their pain. And that was unacceptable to God. For that reason, they would be judged, not just at the time when they fell, but also for the remainder of time. At the very end of the book, if you're still there, let's go ahead and read verse 21. And Savior shall come up upon Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. So even though saviors will come up for the land of Israel, no one will come up for Edom. They will be judged even at that time when the Lord's kingdom is established. And that transitions right in nicely to our look ahead at Christ in the book of Obadiah. Christ will ultimately rule the kingdom and bring deliverance to Zion. He is the one whose kingdom is prophesied at the very end of the book in a few words. And it's not just referring to the time when the Jews returned from Babylon, because it refers to the later time when Christ will actually be reigning in the millennium. So even though Israel was scoffed at by Edom, even though Edom made fun of Israel, Israel's future is far better than Edom's, because Israel is God's chosen people. And that leads us to a key theme, one that has been brought to light time and time and time again through the books of history, through Psalms, Proverbs, prophets, and that is that God will avenge his people. And this goes way back to the time of Abraham and the Abrahamic covenant, Genesis 12, 2 through 3. And I have those verses up there on the screen. I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. And in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. So evidently, God considered Edom, the Edomites' violence against Israel, and their rejoicing at Israel's distress to be such a significant offense that it was a curse. And in their curse, he cursed them for their enmity to Israel. Another key theme that we discover in the book is that pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. And of course, that is Proverbs 16:18. But let's go back and read verses 2 through 9 of Obadiah really quickly. Behold, I have made thee small among the heathen. Thou art greatly despised. So it was kind of ironic that this small people that was hidden in such a great secret place, such a defensible valley, they had got such a big opinion of themselves when in fact they were a tiny nation despised by everyone around them. The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee, thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, who shall bring me down to the ground? Though thou exalt thyself as the eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord. No matter how high they thought they were, God would bring them down. If thieves came to thee, if robbers by night, how art thou cut off? Would they not have stolen till they had enough? If the grape gatherers came to thee, would they not leave some grapes? So, normally, if a land is being harvested or taken, there'd be something left. But God prophesies a time when nothing will be left, absolutely removed and destroyed. How are the hidden things of Esau searched out? How are his hidden things sought up? All the men of thy confederacy have brought thee even to the border. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee. They that eat thy bread have laid a wound under thee. There is none understanding in him. Shall I not in that day, saith the Lord, even destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of the mount of Esau? And thy mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed, to the end that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. That's a pretty grim description of a day of judgment for a people that offended God by despising his chosen people. And it also is a very grim description of what happens when we allow pride to build ourselves up, to make us think of ourselves better than we thought, than we should. The Edomites thought their land was impregnable. They scoffed, thinking they were perfectly safe, and their confidence made perfect sense, humanly speaking. The land of Petra, a valley, only accessible by a small path, easily defensible against an entire army. High in the mountains, a rock fortress, not easily taken. So, you know, humanly speaking, their confidence made perfect sense, but they forgot to take God's omnipotence into account. When God says something, it will occur. So our key word is pride. To feel a special sense of accomplishment based on one's perceived achievements. Think you've gotten something done and to feel good about it, putting it in simple words. Their pride was a natural reaction to the success in building their civilization. Their pride was unsupported by reality, and their pride eventually saw them brought low to the ground. Pride is not something that God approves of, as we move on to our application. And I've got some verses here which we're running low on time, so we won't actually read through all of them, but Proverbs 8:13, when you fear the Lord, you hate pride. Pride is not something that lives together with the fear of God, or the fear of God that brings wisdom. It's not a wise thing to indulge in. Proverbs 11:2, pride brings shame, as the Edomites discovered. Proverbs 13:10, pride results in contention. If two people are proud, too proud to admit that they're wrong, they're going to start butting heads. There's going to be a fight. There's going to be contention. Proverbs 14:3, pride is an expression of foolishness. So it's not the wisdom that comes with the fear of the Lord, it's actually foolishness. Mark 7:20-22, pride is a personally defiling attribute. 2 Timothy 3:1-5, pride will be a perilous characteristic of the last days. If you look around, We believe we're living in the last days. Is pride evident today? I believe if you look around, pride is very evident in many people. I know as I was preparing this lesson, thinking back over my own actions, I saw a lot of pride. Pride is a very easy sin to fall into, because when you think you've accomplished something, it's natural to want to feel good about it. And then you allow that good feeling to just kind of bubble and bubble and bubble, and soon no one can be any better than you. Pride is a dangerous, a perilous characteristic of the last days. As a matter of fact, let's go ahead and read some of those verses in 2 Timothy chapter 3. This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud. There's the word that we're looking for in our application. Blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying the power thereof. And then those verses end with a command, from such turn away. So it's a perilous characteristic of the last days, because it's possible even to be proud, to think you have a form of godliness, but in your pride denying the power that is capable of changing you and making you more like God. If you're too proud, then your heart will not be ready to change, because you don't think there's anything to change. From that kind of person, Paul says, we need to turn away. Pride does not belong in the heart of a Christian. And then our last verse, James 4:6, God resists the proud, but gives grace unto the humble. And that is our application, our final application. God loves humility. He hates pride, but he loves and gives grace to the humble. James 4:6, we just read, quoted it. 1 Peter 5:5 says the same thing. And so our final application tonight, let us remember humility in all of our actions, so God will not have to bring us low for our pride. Let's go ahead and divide up for prayer.